If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
He messes up for MI6, he gets kicked out, and that should have been the end of it, but by this point, he's got such a big reputation within the intelligence world for being just this intuitive, natural, gifted spy master that he then gets taken on by MI5. And MI5 ask him to run their first ever agent running section.
That was Henry Hemming talking about the 20th century spy master Maxwell Knight.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. A few days ago, our publisher Dave Musgrove paid a visit to the Chalk Valley History Festival, where he caught up with the author and historian Henry Hemming. Henry had in fact just come off stage, having delivered a talk on his latest book, which is entitled M, Maxwell Knight, MI5's Greatest Spymaster. Dave was keen to find out more, and began by asking Henry to set the scene for this fascinating spy story.
So the heart of the action is during the darkest days of the Second World War. So that's the climax of the book is basically 1940. And the book starts, the narrative begins 20 years previously. So it starts in the early 1920s. And we meet Maxwell Knight as a guy whose life is apparently falling apart. He's lost his job. He's addicted to jazz. He's spending a lot of his time and money on just music, going out, getting drunk. His family have cut him off. He's got this weird collection of animals at home, including at this point a pet bear, which he'd take for walks down the King's Road, and passers-by would mistake it for an exuberant chow puppy. So, from an outsider's point of view, things are not going well. And it's at this point that he has this meeting, this conversation that will completely change his life. And he meets a guy called John Baker White, who asks him to join a private intelligence agency. So this is a sort of fairly right-wing intelligence agency that sort of the MI5 are aware of, but are not being funded by MI5.
Wait a second, there's something missing here. So this guy, apparently a loser, got a pet bear, strange man. Why would somebody ask him to join a security agency?
They thought he had something different about him. They thought he was observant. They thought he might be able to have a go of it. I mean, the other thing is, they needed a lot of people. So they were recruiting left, right and centre. And the main thing they looked for, funnily enough, was just people who came across as being patriotic. And Maxwell Knight, at that point in his life, definitely came across as an ardent patriot. So I think that was actually his main qualification. And, I mean, a lot of these agents would fall by the wayside. They'd spend a couple of weeks in the job and just blab about it to someone, or get bored, or they get discovered by the people they were spying on. But Maxwell Knight was different, and it emerged very, very soon that this was something he was really good at. He had the patience to be a good spy. He had the understanding of human nature to work out what people around him were thinking and wanting to do, and reading their intentions. And for the first time, basically, he'd found his calling. And he did this job so well, the job was to infiltrate an extremist group, that he was then asked by his boss to start running his own spies. So he crosses over. It's a bit like being a football player who then turns to being football manager. So he's now kind of player manager. He's doing some spying himself, but he's also running these different agents. And this is where he comes into his own even more. He has a knack. He has a knack, and I think without, you know, giving away too soon the kind of the heart of the book, I argue in M that the reason he was so good at this was because as a child, he spent a lot of time looking after animals. So he was always collecting injured animals he found in the woods and fields around his home. He would bring them back to health. He would monitor them, make sure they had exactly what they wanted, when they needed it. And strangely, those same skills applied to being a spy master. And no one could have predicted this, but that's how it happened. And so he, by the late 20s, he is this talented, successful spy master, and he gets taken on by MI6. He then, I won't go too much into the details, he messes up for MI6, he gets kicked out, and that should have been the end of it. But by this point, he's got such a big reputation within the intelligence world for being just this intuitive, natural, gifted spy master, that he then gets taken on by MI5. And MI5 ask him to run their first ever agent running section. So this is where the narrative really gets going. It's his big break.
You're kind of describing a world here with lots of different secret services and agencies going on. Is that a fair picture of what's happening in the 20s and 30s? Are there lots of spies wandering around, newspapers sat on benches, that sort of thing?
Definitely. And I think the way to understand it is the historical fear that was going on, and that was the fear of the Soviet Union, of international communism. And at the same time, MI5 had very little money. And what this meant was that they would use groups like the one that was employing Maxwell Knight, as well as others. So they wanted to get intelligence. They didn't have the money to do it themselves. So if there were rich industrialists who wanted to help take on the Soviet Union, they were more than happy to get them running their own agencies and to benefit from their work. So you do have this strange, almost chaotic world of lots of different rival groups. And it's also, it's weirdly amateur. It really, really is. I mean, again and again, when I was researching this book, I'd come across something and I just think this can't be real. And I mean, someone like Maxwell Knight, he never had any training and he never gave any of his agents long training courses. They were encouraged to make it up on the spot. And a lot of the time, they were just referring back to things they'd read in spy novels or things they'd seen in the cinema once spy films began to come out in the late 1920s. So it was slightly chaotic, it was amateur, and there are a lot of things that happened that would never happen today. But by the early 30s, it's getting a little bit more professional, and that's when M really comes into his own.
Okay, so hold on a second. So we're calling him M now.
Yeah.
So Maxwell Knight, he's joined MI5, this eccentric amateur with a pet bear, other strange things going on. He gets into MI5 and then suddenly he starts calling himself M.
Yeah.
How do we get to that?
So as far as I know, it was the moment he joined MI5. He joins MI5 and he says, not only do I want to be known as M, so all of the letters between him and colleagues would be him signing off as M, people referring to him in letters as M. But he also says, my new section, it's got to be called M Section or M Organization. And then all of his the code names for his agents are M1, M2, M3 and MABC and so on.
And is this just a reflection of his general eccentricity, or was there some particular reason why he wanted this to...
Well, it's a really interesting question. When I first sort of took this on, I assumed it was him just using his Christian name just because he sort of liked it. And,
yep.
And it made me think there was a bit of an egotist in there. But I then found one crucial piece of evidence, which shows that actually the M referred to his former boss. So the guy who'd recruited him to this private intelligence agency, he was called McGill. And his outfit was called the McGill Organization. And so when M joined MI5, he said, right, I want to run the M Organization. And that was his way of continuing the tradition of this slightly more cavalier, swashbuckling, buccaneering outfit. So he always saw himself as being slightly apart from MI5. And he insisted on running his operation not from MI5 headquarters, but just from his own house, which today would not be thinkable. It's the worst possible tradecraft. But he prided himself on this, on being separate, running his own show and having his own rules.
And the title of your book suggests that that was a successful strategy and that he was good at the job.
I think he was, yes. You can debate who exactly was the greatest MI5 spy master. Ben McIntyre, when he reviewed my book in the Times, he went for Tara Robertson. And I think Tara Robertson is a kind of very, very close. I'd put him in a sort of second. I think Max von Eye was a little bit better in terms of his record, in terms of how long he was running agents for, and also in terms of how many agents he would have on the go. I think that's something which really sets him apart. But yeah, during the 30s, he establishes himself as this extraordinarily successful and productive spy master.
Can you give us just a little taste of some of his successes then? What did he do?
Yeah, one of the biggest, most sort of headline-grabbing successes was breaking up the Soviet spy ring that was stealing secrets from the Woolwich Arsenal. And he had one of his agents right at the heart of the spy ring, somebody called Olga Gray. But I suppose in a sort of less headline-grabbing way, he had so many agents inside the Communist Party, at sort of senior level, lower level too, that he was able to give back to MI5 and therefore be passed on to the British government a really detailed picture of what was going on inside the Communist Party, what their connection to Moscow was, what Moscow's plans were. And in some ways, that kind of reduced the sense of threat. Because as at the moment, MI5 realised that there was no imminent revolution and they had the agents inside the party to prove it. That allowed the government to change its policy towards the Soviet Union and to relax it in some ways. So that's one of the things that really has an impact. But I think more substantially, it's what he does during the Second World War, which I think really, really sets him apart and is something which I hope he's remembered for. So he, when he was a young man, he had to infiltrate the British fascisti. And he did this really well. And he developed a lot of friendships, which, and he would argue he was doing it just to be a good spy. You know, he had to come across as being friendly to all these people. But during the 30s, as fascism becomes more of a threat, and increasingly Nazi Germany is the greatest threat to Britain, not the Soviet Union, M begins to find himself in this conflicted place. In other words, the people who he was once friends with are now senior figures in the fascist party. And he has to decide what to do about this. He has to decide, you know, how far MI5 should go in investigating and then prosecuting these people that he once was good friends with. And I think it comes down to this classic choice that he has to make between his friends and his country. And during the 30s, he can kind of fudge it. He doesn't have to really choose one over the other. But during the war, he does. And at the very start of the war, he makes this incredible mistake where he calls up one of his fascist friends, a guy called William Joyce, who then becomes Lord Haw. He calls him up in August, late August 1939, and he tells William Joyce that he's going to be arrested, or Joyce is going to be arrested. And I think he did that so that Joyce would have his affairs in order and he'd be ready when there's a knock at the door and the police came. But instead, as we know, Joyce fled the country, went to Berlin, became the most important Nazi propagandist broadcasting back into Britain. And this was easily the biggest blunder of M's career. He'd chosen his friend over his country. And he then, I argue in the book, does everything he can to atone for that. And he then starts, if anything, overcompensating the other way. So he starts pouring agents into the British right, fascist organisations, far-right organisations. And he then starts scheming behind the scenes to try and bring about the internment of all senior fascists. And this is something which is debated to this day. You know, was it either morally or indeed legally correct for the British government to intern? In the end, it was 1,000. I think it was 1,000 members of the BUF who were behind bars, 1,500 fascists in total. And as I found in the book, there's good evidence to show that M was one of the key players in making that happen. And that internment really did for British fascism. So when people like Oswald Mosley tried to relaunch their career after the war, and other people tried to reinvent fascism, it was the internment more than anything else, perhaps, which meant that this just never got off the ground. So I think M's role in bringing about the internment makes him one of the main architects of the end of British fascism, which is remarkable given his early involvement in this group.
Sure. I'm curious how he got away with that, what sounds like a major security breach.
Yeah.
Why wasn't he chastised?
I think the only answer I can come up with is, I mean, I've seen the kind of the correspondence between members of MI5 describing what had happened. M argued that that yes, he did have a conversation with Joyce at that time, but he never mentioned what he was said to have mentioned. But the evidence is absolutely clear. It's I won't go into the details, but there's no doubt that he did. I think at that point, MI5 was at breaking point. It was close to collapse, and it had so much work. It had to expand at such speed that the idea of sacking somebody who was this revered spymaster was not something they were prepared to do. I think had that happened at any other point in MI5's history, he would have been out.
So this guy's got an afterlife, clearly, in the scope of James Bond novels.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that come about? Why was he chosen as a figure?
There's a long debate about who exactly was chosen. I think the main role model for M was John Godfrey, director of Naval Intelligence during the war, and Ian Fleming's boss. And certainly kind of the character of the James Bond M is very similar to Godfrey's character. But I think when it comes to the choice of name, some people have said it was Gubbins in SOE who was the main influence. But I would argue that when Fleming joined British intelligence, the preeminent M by far was Maxwell Knight. And he'd been known as M since 1931. He'd remain being known as M until 61. His section was called M Section. His agents were called M this and that. And crucially, he liaised with all sorts of different branches of British intelligence. So he was well known within that world as M. And I think that's why he has a claim.
Sure. But actually, there's a very interesting story of his actual life that follows up, which you were talking about in your talk, which he becomes a David Attenborough-esque
figure.
Yeah,
it's so completely unexpected as to be almost unbelievable. He from the 1950s onwards, while he's still working at MI5, he reinvents himself as this radio presenter, working for the BBC, talking not about espionage, not about politics, but about pets. And he talks about his own pets, about other people's pets. He does 300 radio programs during the 1950s, 40 TV programs, 20 books. And in none of them does he even hint at some other hidden life. And it's strange. So he, at the same time as being fully employed as an MI5 spymaster, he's also rushing off to BBC studios to film stuff or to record things. And I think, so I kept asking myself, when I was writing the book, why? Why bother? Why not just stick to the espionage? And I think deep down, this was a man who had to be seen. He was something of an extrovert. He was someone who, I mean, without being too much of a sort of poor man's Freud, his dad ignored him. His dad was busy having affairs when he was growing up. He was the youngest son. And there's even an argument that the reason he began to collect animals when he was younger was to impress his dad, to get his dad's attention. And being a spy obviously meant that he wasn't going to get any attention. He tried to write these trashy novels. They didn't really take off. And even there, that was him wanting to be well known. He wanted them to be as popular as possible. But I think finally he gets his wish when he reinvents himself as a popular naturalist. And he becomes a national treasure. Becomes incredibly well known to millions of people.
And was there any inkling that he had this other life from the radio?
As far as I'm aware, absolutely none. The closest I got was talking to Desmond Morris, who broadcast with him a few times, and he said that he didn't put two and two together, but he definitely noticed that at the end of all these broadcasts, M, or Max as he was known, would be picked up by this enormous black official-looking car, but as Desmond put it, he thought that was just something else going on. That maybe he'd married a rich woman who had a chauffeur in a large black car. And it was only when He was revealed, and was revealed to have been an MI5 spymaster that Desmond Morris had put two and two together.
It's a very extraordinary world you're describing here of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, of the, you know, people driving around in big cars, having pet bears, snakes in their pocket, and all sorts of strange things. It just seems... it seems almost unbelievable in a way that, that world was going on. Is it a completely unrepresentative bit of life here, of, you know, some strange, eccentric quarter of London life that you're describing?
I mean, yes and no. I think in terms of the 30s, which was in his prime, no, it was not too unusual. But certainly in the 1950s, he was seen in MI5 as yesterday's man. He was seen as someone whose methods, whose way of thinking was very much pre-war. And also, I suppose, when I'm writing the book, I'm more interested in some of the colourful things, and definitely we've been talking about that more. Maybe that's unrepresentative. But the reason he stayed on in MI5 for so long was that even from during 1943 onwards, He was warning people in MI5 of the threat of the Soviet Union, and most people in MI5 thought that was absurd. They thought the idea that the Soviet Union, which was then just on its knees, would have either the desire, let alone the nous, to put together international espionage and to have sleeper agents inside the British government, they thought that was ridiculous. And this is something that M predicted quite precisely in several papers. And for the, you know, during the early 1950s, he was slightly laughed at by others in MI5. But then, as it became clear just the extent to which he'd been right, then he sort of had a second wind in MI5. So I think that extended his career. And someone who should, because of his style, his methods and everything, who should really have retired in the late 40s, kept going until 1961.
Was this a particularly tricky topic to research? I imagine the archives are not necessarily easily accessible, or are they all now free and available?
Well, it's a funny thing. So MI6 won't release anything. MI5, by contrast, are releasing huge amounts. And so every few months there'll be a dump of new material, and which is always very exciting when you're researching this stuff. You never know what's going to be released. So MI5's records are very much available. And I mean, obviously there are some things that are redacted and kept out, but there's a huge amount there. It's an exciting place to be as a historian because it keeps changing. And our understanding of what MI5 was doing just becomes richer with every month that goes by.
And so, final question. You're saying all these documents are appearing and there's lots of new sources happening every now and again. Are there any secrets that M has taken to his grave that you really wanted to identify?
Yes, there's one really, really big one. So his nephew showed me a gold cigarette case, which had the royal cipher. So it came from King George V. And then had inscribed on the inside, engraved rather, just Maxwell Knight, 1931. And his nephew told me that his aunt and his granny and his mum, they all knew the story. But they said the story was so secret and so scandalous that they couldn't tell anyone. And so not only did M take the secret to his grave, but so did his sister and mother-in-law and so on. So that secret, I think, has gone. I've got a suspicion as to what it was, given the date and the fact that it came from the king. I think it was to do with blackmail of one of his sons and possibly a gay lover. But that's speculation.
Wow, what a way to end. Henry, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was Henry Hemming on location at the Chalk Valley History Festival. M, Maxwell Knight, MI5's greatest spymaster, is out now in the UK published by Preface, and in the US where it's published by Public Affairs. You can find out more about the Chalk Valley History Festival at cvhf.org.uk. Meanwhile, we're getting closer to our own History Weekend events, which take place in October and November in the historic cities of Winchester and York. The lineups include the likes of Michael Wood, Dan Jones, Yanina Ramirez, and Alison Weir, and tickets are selling fast. You can find out more details and book tickets at historyweekend.com. Well, that's about it for this episode, but please do join us again on Thursday for more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast. which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.